I'm Brad Linder, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller's off tonight. Ahead, the process of packing up as Philadelphia's Mayor Michael Nutter leaves office. First, Philadelphia's traditional New Year's celebration was interrupted by protesters today. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports police worked hard to keep them off the parade route.
The protest was reminiscent of Occupy Philadelphia and had many of the same protesters. Asa Khalif of the group Black Lives Matter says they targeted the event because they wanted to use a major public gathering to show their displeasure.
We are not going to apologize because we're black. We're not going to apologize because we're in a racist system and we're going to shut it down each and every time.
Protester Megan Malachi believes the Mummers Parade is inherently racist because of the use of blackface in the past, and she as a child in Philadelphia never went to the event.
Our reasons for being out here are to raise awareness of the police terrorism that is systemic and brutal in Philadelphia. We also have people representing groups who are part of the Fight for 15 movement to get fast food workers a living wage, educational inequality, and also environmental issues.
At its peak, there were only about 50 protesters, and police were able to keep all but a few off the streets. Those who got through were arrested and taken away from the protest. Michael McGrail marches with the Froggy Car Comics. He says the protesters picked the wrong time to vent their frustrations.
There's other places that I think are more, could be more productive and more constructive for them to make their point. Now is not the appropriate place to make it. All they're doing is alienating people by making this, bringing this point to the general public.
Police had to stop several parade watchers from entering into physical confrontations with the protesters, and there were many profanity-laced shouting matches as the protesters and the parade watchers tussled along the parade route. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
The year closed with Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane fighting for her political life, facing criminal charges and other challenges from all three branches of state government. WHYY's Mary Wilson has a look back at one of our top stories of 2015.
The criminal case against Kane was filed in August. Prosecutors charged Kane with perjury, conspiracy, and other crimes, saying she leaked secret investigative information to embarrass a critic and later lied about it under oath. Kane maintains her innocence, saying the case against her was manufactured by an old boys network trying to stop her from releasing their lewd emails, which she uncovered on her office's servers. After Kane was charged, she suggested that the release of the pornographic and insensitive messages would tell the whole story.
I do that not as a part of some vendetta. I do that to begin to tell the truth and the whole story. A story that is critical to my defense against these charges.
Kane has since tasked outside counsel with an investigation of the emails. Following her indictment, Governor Tom Wolf, a fellow Democrat, called for her to resign. Kane says she won't step down. The state Supreme Court suspended her law license indefinitely due to the charges against her. In light of that, the state Senate has begun to formally consider her ouster. A hearing to allow Kane to defend herself has been scheduled in January. The attorney general considers the Senate's process unconstitutional, but her top deputies have said Kane's lack of a law license has created problems for the work of their agency. Mary Wilson in Harrisburg.
Housing choice vouchers, formerly known as Section 8, help low-income people secure housing by paying a share of their rent in the private market. But in Pittsburgh, just 25% of voucher recipients end up using them successfully. Why? Many reasons are out of the housing authority's hands. There's still discrimination against Section 8 tenants, subpar units fail mandatory inspection, and some landlords avoid the government bureaucracy. But there is something housing authorities can do, as Keystone Crossroads' Irina Zhorov reports.
Reuben Sumter has a Section 8 voucher and has been in his apartment in the East Liberty neighborhood of Pittsburgh for about two decades.
I like my apartment, so I have to give it up.
He has to give it up because the owner is redeveloping it and hiking up rents. The most important thing for Sumter is staying in East Liberty. He has Parkinson's and his doctor is there. The church where he helps out is there too.
I know my place. You know my way around. It's very important because people that knew me, they keep the golden rule. And I help a lot of people, and they help me, we help each other.
Sumter has to be out by the end of February. He's been searching for a new place for nearly 3 months, and so far has only found waiting lists.
See, this way it stands.
Ultimately, whether he stays in East Liberty or not may not be his choice, which is a little ironic. The Section 8 program was established in the 1970s to give low-income families choice. You pick where you want to live. The government just helps you pay for it. Pittsburgh Councilman Ricky Burgess says choice still matters.
You can only be in certain neighborhoods. Certainly your kids can only go to certain schools, and in that neighborhood doesn't have good transportation, then in many ways you're also being discriminated from good jobs. And if you live in certain neighborhoods and the crime rate is high, it just sort of snowballs.
The thing is, that choice is often theoretical. Affordable housing that accepts Section 8 vouchers is increasingly harder to come by in various Pennsylvania cities. That's true in Pittsburgh as well.
The primary reason is because the market has gone up. Landlords can get more money without using the voucher program, so they do.
That's David Weber, COO of the Pittsburgh Housing Authority. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD, caps payments through its fair market rents. Those rents are supposed to cover modest housing, beyond cheap rundown rentals, but not the brand new expensive units either. Weber says those caps lag behind the market, which can be a problem in quickly gentrifying areas like Pittsburgh's East End.
They're also based on the metropolitan statistical area, so it includes like a 7-county region, and so that doesn't reflect the rental market, say, in the East End of Pittsburgh right now. So that's a major obstacle for a lot of folks at the moment.
As a result, renters using Section 8 vouchers often concentrate in neighborhoods that have more poverty and fewer opportunities, because that's where the vouchers cover rent. Weber knows this. Already, the Pittsburgh Housing Authority sets rents at 110% of HUD's figures to give participants more flexibility. The agency is currently trying to up that to 120%, something they hope to implement next spring. Some cities like Dallas have tried a different approach. They've localized fair market rents, covering more inexpensive areas, less in poor neighborhoods. Kevin Quisenberry, a lawyer for the Community Justice Project in Pittsburgh, says that may be a better approach. He points to downtown Pittsburgh, where rents have gone up with redevelopment, as an example of why.
The payment standard, even at 120% of area FMR, is never going to provide very minimal rental opportunities in downtown Pittsburgh, which, as you know, is a super high opportunity area residentially.
Right now, East Liberty is about 11% Section 8 units. But as the neighborhood develops and attracts wealthier newcomers, that may change. For Ruben Sumpter and other Section 8 participants who want to take advantage of the new East Liberty, that choice may become increasingly out of reach. Irina Zhorov, Keystone Crossroads.
To see an interactive map of where Section 8 units are clustered in Pittsburgh, go to KeystoneCrossroads.org. Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media collaboration focusing on Pennsylvania cities, their problems, and potential solutions. WHYY leads the four-station initiative. In today's headlines, former New Jersey Secretary of Agriculture Charles Cooperus has died. Family members say he died of cancer Wednesday at his Sussex home. He was 57. Cooperus served on the Sussex County Board of Agriculture, the New Jersey Farm Bureau, and the State Planning Commission. He was named Agriculture Secretary in 2002 by Governor James McGreevy and served until 2008, overseeing the preservation of more than 1,100 farms and 85,000 acres of farmland throughout the state. Cooperus was born in Sussex and grew up on a family dairy farm. He founded Cooperus Farmside Gardens in 1979. A central New Jersey mayor has been sworn into office by a U.S. Supreme Court justice. Samuel Alito administered the oath of office to Hamilton Township Mayor Kelly Yade during a ceremony Friday that was attended by several hundred people. Yade won her first full four-year term last November. Alito was born in Trenton and raised in Hamilton. The Princeton University and Yale Law School graduate has served on the nation's top court since January 2006. Nestle Waters says its proposed water extraction facility in the Poconos won't impact nearby residential water wells or result in significant increases in traffic or noise. The Pocono Record reports that Nestle wants to withdraw 200,000 gallons per day from two wells on private property in Eldred Township for its Deer Park Spring Water brand. Residents are worried the operation will damage residential wells and the environment. Nestle says its own studies show the project is sustainable. The company applied for a zoning permit this week. Project manager Eric Andreas says the facility could be up and running by the summer of 2017. Residents say Nestle's testing doesn't measure the potential long-term impact of the water withdrawals. Checking the forecast, clear skies tonight with a low around 31 degrees. Tomorrow, sunny with a high around 43. Tomorrow night, mostly clear with a low around 32 degrees. Sunday, mostly sunny with a high around 44, and Monday, sunny but cooler with a high near 35. It's 37 degrees at 6:16. This is WHYY. Still ahead, the list of America's most admired people is more varied than you might think.
What we have is enough people out there when we say, who's the man living in the world anywhere that you most admire? Say Trump, that he comes in second on the list, tied with the Pope, but behind the president.
That's coming up as Newsworks Tonight continues.
Updating software can be a pain, but if you don't do it...
We lost all contact with the ground, and we lost insight into all of the systems of our ship.
I'm Adrienne Hill, the multi-billion dollar software business from phones to spaceships. Next time on Marketplace from APM.
Marketplace follows Newsworks Tonight at 6:30 this evening on WHYY.
People's Light presents The Three Musketeers, The Later Years, playing November 18th through January 10th. Audiences will laugh their pantos off as Porthos, Athos, Aramis, and a chicken hunt for justice against the evil Lord Maserati in this musical adventure. Complete with plumed hats and sword fights, The Three Musketeers will have audiences shouting, "All for one and one for all." For tickets, peopleslight.org or 610-644-3500. People's Light supports WHYY.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Brad Linder. On this New Year's Day, let's take a moment to look back at the individual Americans most admired in 2015. In this week's edition of What Are We Thinking, Dave Heller spoke with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup poll, about the men and women making waves in the nation. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, how does Gallup go about assessing this?
We've been doing this for many, many years, going back to the 1940s. It's very simple. It's an open-ended question. We said, who is the man living anywhere in the world that you most admire? New question, who is the woman living anywhere in the world that you most admire? So at top of mind, which is important to remember, we don't prompt them. So this is whomever Americans can dredge up out of their minds when we ask this question.
Start dredging.
Well, on the female side of the equation, David, is Hillary Clinton, and this is very interesting because Hillary Clinton now is the most admired woman for the 20th time, and that is more times than any man or woman in Gallup's history of asking this question going back to the 1940s has been number one.
Interesting, Frank. Isn't she also, at least politically, very polarizing?
She is very polarizing, but this question simply says, who is the woman living anywhere in the world that you most admire? And the same thing for the man. So we just need her supporters to mention her name. And she apparently is top of mind with enough people that like her and that admire her that she trumps any other woman who is out there. Usually there's a problem on the female side because there are not a lot of prominent women, particularly after Mother Teresa and Eleanor Roosevelt passed on, because you have to be living to be on the list, that come to people's minds. So Hillary Clinton has been the one, more than the First Lady most of the time, that has come to mind more than any other female when we ask this question.
Round out the top of the female list.
Malala Yousafzai, the very well-known dissident in Pakistan, is actually number two, followed by Oprah Winfrey, then the First Lady, Michelle Obama, and then some other people with very small percentages of people mentioning them, including presidential candidate Carly Fiorina, Queen Elizabeth, and then some international leaders and others that go down with just a small number of mentions. The number of times that people have been on the list on the female side is topped by Queen Elizabeth II. She was on the list back when she was a princess, before she became queen, back in the 1940s. First, she's been on the list 47 times, the top 10 list over the years. Then Margaret Thatcher, then Jackie Kennedy, and then Oprah Winfrey. Again, one of the issues about these women and men on the list is you have to be living to be on the list. So to some degree, like for Queen Elizabeth, for example, this rewards personalities who've been on the world stage for many, many years and don't die early. They're still around, so they still continue to be on the list.
With that, let's move on to living men.
The top of the list is usually the president, and it is again this year. Barack Obama is the most admired man that comes to mind when we ask this question of Americans. And here's the controversy. Guess who's tied for second? Two individuals who are about as different as two people I can think of. Pope Francis and Donald Trump.
And again, let's be clear, this is not merely a name recognition list, it's most admired.
Well, that's right, and it's top of mind. So again, what we have is enough people out there when we say who's the man living in the world anywhere that you most admire, say Trump, that he comes in second on the list, tied with the Pope, but behind the president.
Is Trump typically on the list?
He was actually on the list back in the 80s and 90s a couple of times when he was well-known, not for running for office, mind you, but because he was a well-known businessman and of course, has had TV exposure as well.
Let's round out the top 10.
Bernie Sanders is on the list, so he has his admirers out there. Then Bill Gates, who, of course, is the founder of Microsoft and the philanthropist. Then presidential candidate Ben Carson, the Dalai Lama, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, and this is important, Reverend Billy Graham. He's 97 years old. He lives in North Carolina. He's ill. He's not in the news, but enough people still think about Billy Graham to name him. And that's important because Billy Graham has been on the top 10 list more than any other male in Gallup's history.
Now, it's interesting, as you noted, that the president is typically the most admired male. Come November, if Hillary Clinton prevails, I wonder who might ascend to that top male category.
A very good question. I would imagine if that comes to pass, if Hillary Clinton is the president, we will have ex-presidents who will come to mind more than anybody else when we ask this question. But let's tune in next year. If that happens, we'll see what Americans tell us.
Frank, best wishes to you and yours for a happy and healthy new year. Let's talk again next week and in November.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
Trees improve urban landscapes in several ways, cleaning the air, cooling summer temperatures, and providing beauty. There's an organization in the region that's adding another benefit to that mix. WHYY's Kimberly Haas visited the Philadelphia Orchard Project.
Philadelphia is in the midst of a green revolution, and it's happening overhead. The urban canopy, the population of street trees, is growing rapidly thanks to several efforts, including the Parks and Rec Department's Tree Philly program, the Water Department's Green City Clean Waters Plan, and the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society's Plant 1 Million Project. And there's an organization that's taking it one step further and planting fruit trees. Phil Forsyth is executive director of the Philadelphia Orchard Project.
A lot of people are fascinated by the idea. It seems to have very broad appeal. Everybody likes the idea of trees, and especially trees that provide fruit. People are often shocked to hear that we have 52 orchards in the city.
That's a lot of trees to look after. Once the initial planning and planting is done, the Orchard Project enlists schools, churches, low-income housing projects, even a prison, to tend the new orchards.
Our community partners are the ones that do the day-to-day care of the orchards, watering and weeding, maintaining, harvesting, and then distributing the produce within their neighborhoods. And so our role is getting them started and then also training them, providing ongoing support and how to maintain those spaces.
One of those partners was a natural fit.
So right here we have our plums.
Aviva Asher is the director of Mill Creek Farm in West Philadelphia. The combination urban farm and community garden also houses an orchard. In addition to producing hundreds of pounds of fruit, Asher says it builds community.
Whenever the farm's open, children in the neighborhood know that they can stop by. And people will tell me, oh, I walk my dog past the farm every day and I pick a peach. People, you know, in the neighborhood feel welcome to take and then are inclined to give back to the garden as well.
The Philadelphia Orchard Project recently marked two milestones, planting its 50th orchard and 1,000th tree. Despite the group's small size, Phil Forsyth says it grows more quickly each year.
So our goal is 4 to 6 new orchards every year. And so we have been ever-increasing demand supporting existing partners and planting new ones.
To celebrate those milestones, an anonymous donor has given the Philadelphia Orchard Project $100,000, a gift they're calling the Pomona Fund, named for the Roman goddess of orchards. For WHYY, I'm Kimberly Haas.
Over the course of a job, most people accumulate stuff, and most of us don't think ahead to if and when we might leave that position. But some jobs come with a fixed end date, and that's the case with today's guest on Recap. This work week was unlike any other he's had in 8 years.
Packing boxes full of 8 years of accumulated mementos, plaques, photos, papers, tore up a lot of paper. That's the bulk of what I've been doing the past week or so. I have a lot of stuff, and it needs to get out of here. I'm Michael Nutter, mayor of the city of Philadelphia, and I work in City Hall. it may not necessarily be as glamorous as it appears, although there are certainly many, quote-unquote glamorous moments. The public time, some days, is a whole lot less than folks might realize. But when we're really kind of going, I could give anywhere from 6 to 8 speeches a day. There are certain things that pretty much always have to be a part of any speech, and then when I get to an event, depending on the crowd and the vibe, often I may go a little off script. Some of the times when there's been language that you would not be able to broadcast on your airwaves, none of that language is ever written into the speech. They're all in the moment. I can be at times a kind of emotional person. I get upset, and I will then express myself in a way that, may be slightly less than Meryl, but it is personal. It is human. People have often heard me talk about the Athenian Oath, which until a couple of days ago when I took it down, was up on my wall. And it's that last line that says that I will discharge the duties of my office with fidelity. I know that I can't solve every possible problem. I know that there are limitations, but it doesn't mean that I'm not going to try. That's who I am. That's what I'm about. Next week, I'm going to take a break.
So long, been good to know you. So long.
That's Philadelphia Mayor Michael Nutter talking about his last week on the job on Recap. You can hear about the work week of others in the region at newsworks.org. Finally tonight, despite protests against the event, the Mummers strummed and danced their way down the streets of Philadelphia for the 116th time. The celebration marked the second year of the Mummers' new route down Broad Street. And to get in the spirit of one of the nation's oldest folk festivals, we figured we'd join the tradition and do a strut of our own to lead into the weekend. Hit it! That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas. We had help this week from Brett Rader. The news director is Eugene Son. Our engineers this week were Audrey Bentham, Diana Martinez, and Adam Stanishevsky. John Musoni is acting vice president of News and Civic Dialogue. You can listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Brad Linder for NewsWorks Tonight.